Hello and welcome to Escape into Storytelling. I'm Jennifer Bradley, and this is a chapter from my self-published novel, Virago. New episodes drop each Monday, and all chapters will be available at the end of the book. As always, there is no charge. Virago is intended for a mature audience, and today's episode contains alcohol consumption and depictions of dementia. If you missed last week's episode, it is available from the same podcast source. Now please, sit back and escape into storytelling with me in today's episode. Chapter 26, in which the year's turn brings hope and fear. The last day of the year, Burning Leaves Eve, arrived crisp and cold, and found Neville helping Hobson open rounds earlier than usual.
"Double shifts for the watch,"
Hobson said, tying his apron on with his intricate one-handed method.
"They won't be drinking much, but we'll be cooking all day. Do you know how many's coming in that private party tonight?"
"All right. Adelaide and her new friends, including that stupid pretty boy watch member."
10 or 11, I think." "Good, good. Get them sausages out the cellar and heat up the hearth. Then we'll get the taters peeled for stew."
Neville grimaced. "I hate peeling potatoes. I always nick myself and my hands smell like dirt."
"How many potatoes?"
Hobson grinned.
"Why, all of them, my lad. All of them."
A familiar silhouette appeared in the open door. Behatted, shabby, and mustached, it sauntered into the pub as if it owned the place.
"Carver!"
Neville smiled as he crossed the floor, his hand outstretched.
"Morning, old son," Carver said, clasping his hand.
He grinned himself, displaying a missing tooth Neville had never noticed before. Inside his tatty old coat, he looked diminished, and his face had a wasted, drawn look. But his mustache was as orange and wide as ever.
"Good to see you." "Aye. Listen, can we talk?"
Carver asked, his eyes darting to the man behind the bar. Hobson had his back to them.
"If you've a moment, like."
"Aye, I'm just heading down cellar. Come on."
Down below, strings of sausages, smoked hams, and waxed wheels of cheese in nets hung from the ceiling. Great oak barrels lined the walls, bellies pregnant with Hobson's latest brew. Smells of yeast, hops, bright white cheddar cheese, and old beer-soaked soil hung in the air.
"You've landed on your feet, you have."
Carver settled himself on the stairs as Neville worked, eyeing their surroundings.
"Thanks. Have a bite."
Neville handed him a sausage and an apple. The offering was accepted and gobbled.
Oh, that is heaven, that is,"
Carver said as grease and apple juice ran down his chin.
"How's Trix? Got anything going?"
Neville piled a basket with sausages.
"Actually, I was hoping you had something on,"
Carver said, smacking his lips.
"Things have been thin on the ground since that fracas in the woods."
Neville shook his head.
"Sorry. Hobson might have some work tonight if you're up for it. Real work, I mean. Waiting tables, cleaning."
Carver waved him off.
"Nah. Oh well. Heard the latest, have you?"
The basket filled, Neville sat on the stair alongside the old gambler, his boot heels scraping on the wooden steps.
"What's the latest?"
Carver chuckled.
"3 idiots of Skinner's got pinched. Funny part was, they was breaking into a livery."
"What's funny about that?"
Carver snorted.
"The 5 watch members playing redsies inside. The idiots lifted up a trap door, came up right under the table. Got pinched before they knew what's what."
Carver took out his pipe and felt his jacket pockets. Finding them empty, he put it away again.
"I seen them same idiots in the blue ribbon asking Simon the Sharp for work. He give it to him, then laughed about it after. I guess it was a setup to get him arrested."
He shook his head.
"He ain't laughing now."
"Why?"
"His father give him a long drink under the ice house. They pulled him out alive, but, well, he won't be any use any time soon. Except if Skinner needs more of them nasty skin necklaces."
Neville winced. Carver nodded, then his face brightened.
"And you? Gonna let your pretty northern girl make an honest man of you now you're doing honest work?"
Neville shook his head, his face guarded.
"Oh well. Too bad. The good ones never stay around long, I found. Say, what with the new year coming up and all? You couldn't spare some help for an old friend, could you?
You've not been eating enough. You've always been shabby, but your clothes never hung like that before, swaying like rags on a line. And I'm sure I remember you had all your teeth only a month ago.
Suddenly Neville thought of Adelaide, and how he'd insisted she hold his money, lest he'd drink or gamble it all away again.
She'd help a friend, no matter what.
What kind of help? Well, there's a job tomorrow night. A friend of mine set it up. It'd be a help to have another strong back along, or just someone on my side.
Neville picked at a hangnail on his thumb.
A muted cry of, "Where's them taters, damn it?" floated down to them. Ah, well, I better let you get back to work.
Carver stood up fast, and his knees popped.
Oof, felt that.
Neville caught the old gambler's hand and pressed a few coins into it.
Take care of yourself. Eat. Don't drink or smoke. Aye, all right, all right. Who needs a woman when I got you looking after me?
Take care of yourself, Carve.
Aye, I'll eat. And if you change your mind, I'll be at the corner of Sunset and Starfish tomorrow, sundown. Should be easy to remember, eh? Sunset, Starfish, sundown.
If I can be there, I'll be there.
As the day wore on, Gert closed the shop early. He was spending the event in Westmont with Alan and some friends.
I'll tell everyone you said hello. See you next year.
The door closed on him, humming to himself. After putting away her work things, Adelaide went upstairs for her shawl and some money.
Winston said East Coast would be crowded tonight since all the people from Glendale and Dockside will be coming up here to let off their lanterns. I'd better go now to get mine, come to think of it.
She set out to the rounds, where everyone was meeting up. Tom and Nora, Miriam, Annabel, Eora, Meggie, Jesse, Madame Yerevny, Lance, and Luthus would all converge on the pub at sundown and stay until the new year began.
The scythe. I never even noticed the rounds, but there it is. And there's that pub Carver and I met with Sawtooth Remiel. That seems so long ago.
The Sky Lantern vendor's line was already 50 feet long. She waved to familiar faces as she found her place in line. Her eye ranged over the street, and for a moment she wondered if her uncle,
Lord Woodburn, I'm to call him Lord Woodburn always,
might be lost among the moving forms, disguised and watching her. But it was a fine night, and she pushed the thought away. Soon, Tom and Nora appeared, the little one sitting on his shoulders.
Evening, Addie, he called. Ready for the new year?
She grinned and nodded.
I used to hate people calling me that, but when Tom does it, I don't mind.
I don't know about you, but I've had the devil's own time understanding how the year changes at midnight. All this talk of days and months and such. City people have a word for everything, don't they?
Aye, days, nights, meals. I suppose if there's no word for something, they don't think it's real.
A family walked past holding their own lantern, a construction of bamboo and paper with a single tiny candle stub within. The lit candle would lift the lantern into the air for a time, then burn out and fall. Tom lifted Nora down and held her hand as she waddled about.
Know what you're gonna put on your lantern?
Eh?
Everybody puts something. Some write if they have words. Others draw pictures. Anything you want. Some put things they want or hopes and dreams. Others put things they want to let go of.
I can write. You want to share a lantern?
His eyes crinkled.
I would, thank you.
We have a lot to let go of, I think.
Their lantern purchased, the trio were walking toward the rounds when she spied Yerevny striding up the street.
I forget how tall she is. She's always sitting behind her desk when I see her.
The Vorosan cut a fine figure in her well-made clothes. She wore a long dress of pale blue velvet and a heavy black coat. Her white nubik peeled out from under the coat's collar, as well as a silver chain.
Her gray locks flowed down her back, sparkling with beads that rattled as she moved. An Ouroussan tricorn perched on her head. She carried a cane with a silver grip. Lance hovered behind her, bundled into brown robes and a dark red scarf. Yerevne pointed with her cane.
See, Lance? I told you we'd find him if we followed the street far enough.
Indeed, madam.
I must say, it is strange but fine being out of my offices. I can't remember when last I was this far from the academy, to be honest.
That trip a few years ago to Jeanne Plyrat's house in the country, a dinner with the Ouroussan ambassador?
Ah, yes. But here, we have some new faces to meet.
As Yerevne was being introduced to Nora, Adelaide spied the Ann and Bell group coming up the street. Annabelle trailed a ribbon of smoke from her home-rolled cigarette. Maggie and Jessie giggled as Adelaide introduced them to Lance. When she reached Eora and Miriam, they were holding hands.
It didn't work out with Simon, Miriam said, shrugging.
Her eyes were ringed with black coal for the occasion. Her hair was plaited close to her head to the nape of her neck, and then fanned out down her back in glistening clock springs.
I told her she could do better, and she did, Eora said, grinning.
Adelaide guided the whole crowd inside the rounds. Neville was down in the basement, but Hobson showed them the way out to the yard where a long trestle table and benches were set up. She excused herself to go wait out front for Luthus. Yerevne accompanied her.
Did you want a sky lantern? I think there are some left.
Voros has its own calendar, so we do not celebrate this new year. But it is good to get out and see the celebration, especially given the history. I do not get out of the academy much.
An explosive belch came from the lantern line. Someone burst into hysterical laughter.
Ah, East Coast. Well done.
Adelaide snorted and shook her head. Yerevne, who could see over the line, turned her head.
There is a large group heading this way. It's almost a mob.
Indeed, a mob of about 30 people made their way down the street. Some children ran or were carried by the many adults, including white-haired people with canes or bent backs. All were smiling, singing, holding hands, or chatting. Most were burnt sienna, freckled Hwathi, but a few white and black faces were present. Luthus walked at the head, carrying a little girl. He gave her a sheepish grin.
Sorry, my cousins and their families all wanted to come.
Chamberlain Maine Gordon stood on the sun terrace, an opulent marble balcony midway up the spear spire's length that commanded a view of all dockside and the ocean beyond. Lamps burned jasmine-scented oil, the marble floor had been dressed in fur rugs and woven carpets, and everywhere servants in the Duchess's livery offered platters of dainties and drinks. A massive table stood just inside, protected by the wind, where gleaming silver platters were piled high with more culinary marvels. His best yellow robes were supplemented with furs against the cold. He eyed the crowd. The rest of the ladies' table members laughed, chatted, and drank, talking business as they waited for the event to begin. Conversation and clothing sparkled. Resplendent in their finery, their velvets were lustrous, and jewelry flashed in the lamplight. He stood apart, swirling his glass of white wine.
Who's tall, and who looks fit enough to climb several hundred feet of sheer stone and then swing into a window without being out of breath? Who has a voice like a low-tuned lute? Is Gray here now? Is he coming later?
His eyes flicked about. They landed on shoulders as he estimated build, paunches as he dismissed fitness, and shoes as he tried to ascertain height. He strained his ears to hear the music and voices, and heard only flat notes and braying. Nearby, Jeanne Plowright radiated in his burnt sienna robes, his dusky, ruggedly handsome face glowing in the low light.
Look at him. He's like a walking bonfire, filling the air with manly warmth. Orswell's decked out in green with her bosoms on display. Galbraith's still rich, Alistair's still loud, and Lord Dust's still alive. All is well.
Gordon scrutinized Plowright, his index finger tapping the side of his glass.
He He's about the right size. And I'm sure all that harrowing and hauling and whatever else farmers do keeps him fit. His voice is wrong, though. Good timbre for stage or pleading the case for hours, but not enough music.
Lord Peldon materialized behind Gordon, clapping a beringed hand onto his shoulder.
I say! Splendid spread, eh? Have you had some of these figs yet? There are almonds and cheese inside. Ugh. He sounds more like Alistair every day. I can see it now. I'll be at Alistair's funeral, somber beside the funeral pyre, turn around and find a junior version has sprung up in his place. There's a grim thought. Alistair has no children. Perhaps he'll reproduce by sprouting. He snorted into his wine.
No, I've eaten nothing yet.
And these little snail things. Marvelous. They do them in butter and garlic, I'm told. Never thought I'd try one, but they're a delight. And the Warosan ambassador's here, so they did some of those... You know.
Peldon looked around, his eyebrow arching. Despite his burning disinterest, Gordon leaned forward.
Beetles! Imagine such an ancient and sophisticated society eating things that live under rocks.
You were just talking about eating snails.
When Gordon did not respond to the presence of cooked beetles on the table, Peldon wandered away in search of more enlivened entertainment. The Warosan ambassador stood several yards away, surrounded by a knot of table members. He gestured with his goblet, his dark face beaming as he spoke. He wore his traditional garb of velvets, furs, a heavy belt, and high boots, all well suited to both the harsh Warosan and milder Vitrilese winters. His graying hair was braided, and a tricorn sat on his head. He attended table meetings only if the matter pertaining to Waros was discussed. Otherwise, he read the minutes. Gordon narrowed his eyes.
He's the right height. But Gray all but showed me he was white that time he drank my wine, although it could have been some clever ruse. Perhaps he was just jesting about seeing me here. Although I'll be damned if I write my hopes and dreams on a piece of burning paper like the shanty trash outside.
He downed his wine and called for another, his paranoia rising from a simmer to a rolling boil. In the place of honor at the center of the terrace, the Duchess nestled in a wheeled chair. She probably wore a fine gown, but was so wrapped in white ermine stalls, no one could tell. Her attendants brought her trays of food, and she nibbled daintily on this or that, rarely chewing anything. Victor stood behind the chair in his usual faded black tatters and scuffed boots, but had the good grace to wear his fine purple cloak. He was flanked by two palace guards and his little clerk. Even the pirate king was there, decked out in silks, precious stones, and his huge plumed hat. The unassuming little man was regaling Lady Galbraith with some tale of derring do, it appeared.
I suppose even the pirate king could be gray if he were a foot taller and 70 pounds lighter. Could it be someone working for him?
It never even occurred to Gordon to wonder if any of the palace guards could be masquerading as gray. He knew them to be physically capable, but mentally to be blunt instruments in scale mail, and nothing more. The party dragged on. Gordon found himself on his fifth glass of wine by the time the ceremony was to begin. By now, singing echoed up from the city. Groundskeepers in the castle garden shot off the rocket just as the evening star, the brightest star in the sky, became visible.
Just like they did all those years ago, the signal that the Empire's tyranny here was done.
He watched, his mouth pursing without him knowing.
None of us would be here now if not for that. Not for her.
As one, the bodies on the terrace fell silent and turned toward the white streak, then drifted to the terrace banister.
What was that, dear?
Gordon glanced around. The Duchess was looking around, clutching her robes.
The signal, Mother, Alistair told her. Remember the signal? That starts the ceremony.
Oh, yes, of course.
The rocket rose to its zenith and exploded into a blue haze that painted the black sky. Its report shook the castle and resonated through the city. Jewels and precious metals sparkled, and faces lit with excitement as the firework bloomed.
Dear me, was that thunder?
No, no, Mother, it's just a firework.
I heard thunder, Alistair.
Gordon heard a squeaking sound. The Duchess was rocking in her chair, wringing her ancient hands. The squeaking came from the wheels as the chair shifted.
We should get inside before it rains.
Alistair touched her shoulder as gently as though she were a newborn kitten.
There now, Mother, it's all right. The sky's clear as glass. See? Not a cloud in the sky. See the stars coming out?
But nothing soothed her. The old head turned about and the hands still wrung. She cowered in the chair, staring up at the sky with cloudy eyes.
For heaven's sake, will they just take her inside?
Gordon drew air in through his nostrils.
She's frightened and she doesn't know where she is.
Most of the table members seemed transfixed by the firework or politely ignored the scene. Others aimed whispers at each other from behind their hands, murmuring about the plight of the elderly and the cruelty of time.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
Victor moved. The black-clad figure waved off the palace guard and went to the chair. He knelt before it, offering the Duchess a gloved hand. The chair stopped rocking as her fragile fingers closed around his.
Victor, when did you get back? Did you hear the thunder, too?
Woodburn nodded, leaned forward, and whispered to her. Gordon leaned to the side, straining his ears. Only after his feet turned cold did he realize he'd spilled his wine. The blue light of the firework faded. The Duchess covered her mouth, her eyes round.
Oh, was I confused again?
Not at all, Your Grace, but perhaps a bit tired. It has been a long day.
Her eyes shone. She lowered her hand.
I'm sorry I ruined the party. Perhaps it's time I went to bed.
Lines formed around Victor's mouth as he smiled at her.
You've ruined nothing, my lady. But perhaps some rest would do you good.
He rose and summoned the attendants with a look that would have got a statue moving. The attendants scrambled, fluffing her pillows and furs and taking hold of the chair's handles. The Duchess was wheeled away, squeaking down the long hallway. Palace guard lining the walls snapped to attention as she passed. Alistair stepped close to the spymaster, both of them watching her leave. Defying everything Gordon knew to be true of the universe, Alistair whispered something. It sounded like,
any day now. Yes, I fear it too.
In East Coast, the grassy yard behind the rounds was crammed with people. They filled the table, sat on the grass, or sprawled on blankets. Children laughed and chased each other through the bodies. Nora and another toddler were engaged in a contest that was part giggling, part screaming. Over it all, voices lifted in song. Gather round the pyres, rake out the ashes old. Thursday we shall have some fires, summer has grown cold. Long night comes to an end, all visitors must away. Tell me you shall be my friend to start this fine new day. People knocked their fists on the table to keep time, making cups and plates dance.
I shall be your friend. Shall you be my friend?
When not singing, the voices called out the questions and answers to each other. I shall be your friend was the secret code enemies of the Empire used to identify themselves when the revolution was being planned. Neville and Hobson ran about filling orders. They'd run out of food, but a woman with a hot sausage wagon wandered by and was now making an entire month's profit off the group. Torches and oil lamps burned in tall sconces set into the ground.
There you go, get that in your face, the sausage woman said for the 10th time as she doled out sausages. There you go, get that in. Oh, excuse me, madam.
Not at all.
Madame Yerevny took a sausage with polite curiosity. Luthus looked over the crowd, pointing out his cousins to Adelaide.
That one, her, him, them, that one.
Oh, whoops, that's a neighbor I grew up with.
There's so many of you. I'll never keep them all straight.
She put a hand over her mouth.
Oh, sorry.
He waved her off.
Don't worry about it.
I called a baby cousin by the wrong name for 2 years. One day she said, I'm not Isabel, I'm Mary.
And you've no brothers or sisters?
Nope. My mother has 3 sisters and a brother. My father, 4 brothers and a sister.
Are your parents here tonight?
They're in Westmont. Father has a friend who works in the castle stables, so they're watching from the servants' pavilion. He cleared his throat, his fingers finding hers. Adelaide, would you like to have dinner with us one night? With my family?
She smiled and leaned against him. I would. Can I help cook anything?
If you like.
He folded around her and kissed her on the temple.
The song ended. Someone started singing in Huathi. We'll be lighting the sky lantern soon.
Luthus raised his legs over the bench and turned to face the sea. The fireworks' smoky outline hung in the air, drifting over the city like a giant dandelion head.
Did you put anything on yours?
Aye. Tom and I shared a lantern.
She held up the bell of rice paper and bent bamboo slivers.
He tilted his head sideways, moving his lips.
Hannah, Jacob, Lena. Who are they?
People from before I came to the city.
She looked back down at the lantern, tracing the letters with a fingertip. Will you tell me what happened?
She touched his hand. Not right now. Another time.
Neville brought out some lit candles and everyone with a lantern got in line. Most of the lanterns had some form of writing on them, or pictures and symbols. Miriam and Iorda giggled together, making fun of each other's drawings. Soon all the lanterns were lit. Flickering candlelight danced over shining faces and glittering eyes as they waited for the signal. A horn blew from the castle. Dozens of arms lifted the rice paper lanterns into the air. The heat from the small candles inside filled the bell-shaped tops and bore them gently aloft. Like giant fireflies, they drifted out over the sea cliffs and filled the sky. Cold starlight disappeared behind the warm glow.
Look! Look at the castle!
Across the city in Westmont, a golden cloud floated away from the base of the castle. As the little lights drifted, they separated from their brethren and were eventually borne down to the black plain of the sea. All along the cliffs of East Coast, the sky was alight.
Look down there!
In Dockside, a handful of lights floated from the end of the northernmost jetty. The golden spots barely rose into the air before they sank down to the black waves. The celebration went on long after Rounds ran out of ale, wine, and food. Hobson gave up the ghost, shut the front door, and came out to visit.
Thank you. This was most entertaining,
Eurephany said as she watched the members of Luthus's family collect themselves. It was well past midnight. Children had passed out from too much excitement, and a few adults were passed out from too much of everything else.
I can find someone to walk you back to the academy, if you like,
Luthus offered, glancing at Lance. Eurevni grinned, her white teeth flashing in the dark.
Yes. Come here a moment, would you?
Adelaide watched them walk a little ways away from the crowd and turn their backs. Eurevni lifted her cane. There was a hiss, then a low whistle. Luthus returned, looking impressed.
She has a 3-foot sword in that cane.
Ooh. Aren't blades that long illegal?
He snorted and winked.
I'll worry about that next year.
A cousin called to him and he wandered off. Madame Eurevni winked at Adelaide, then bade them goodbye. Lance hurried after, beset on both sides by Maggie and Jesse, who had plied him with food and attention all night. Miriam and Iora approached.
Are you going?
Miriam nodded. She yawned and rubbed her eyes, smearing her coal. She swore when she saw the blackened fingertips. Adelaide offered her a clean rag, but the girl shook her head. Miriam glanced at Luthus in the middle of a knot of people.
Did I hear him invite you to meet his parents?
Aye. Miriam grinned, taking her hand.
That means he really likes you. That it's, you know, more than just walking around town and sleeping together and such. Eora nodded, stifling another yawn. Before she could respond, Luthus returned. A sleeping child hung on his back like a drooling knapsack.
This one's mother had too much ale. I'm helping her and her husband take them all home.
Be safe on your walk.
Adelaide leaned forward and kissed him.
I'll see you later.
With a grin that made her face hot despite the cold, he hurried off. As she turned back to Miriam and Eora, a flash of light caught her eye. Far, far out on the black plain of the sea, there was a vague smear of purplish light.
A storm? Must be some terrible lightning to be that bright, so far away.
This concludes Chapter 26 of Virago. Stay tuned for the next episode, Chapter 27, in which Winston takes a risk in looking for help, and precious things are both found and, tragically, lost. If you want to read along, Virago will be available in abridged print or ebook format from Amazon later this year. If you enjoyed this work, please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Escape into Storytelling. Thank you for supporting independent and self-published authors like me. Until next time, be seeing you.